You're listening to a ComicsXF podcast.
WMQA.
Hello and welcome to WMQA, the ComicsXF interview podcast, where two best friends talk about comics with the people who make them. I'm Dan Grote.
And I'm Matt Laswitz.
And this week's guest is the co-writer of the Image comic series Scrapper, due out in trade April 24th, Alex DeCampi. Welcome, Alex.
Hello.
So you're a first-time guest. You get the first-time guest question. What are some of the first comics you remember reading?
Asterix. Definitely Asterix. Probably Claremont's X-Men. Probably some Tintin in there.
Okay. I'm seeing a lot of European influence here. Well, listen, you're here to talk about Scrapper, your book with co-writer Cliff Bleszinski, artist Sandy Jarrell, Ryan Kelly, colorist Jordy Belair. Matt, be a good boy and read the thing.
Scrapper is a good dog, adopted by good people. Sure, he spends his night patrolling his post-apocalyptic metropolis with his buddy Tank, protecting its citizens from the city's totalitarian overlords, but everyone needs a hobby, right? When a catastrophe sends Scrapper's world spiraling out of control, he will need to rally the city's critters to save both themselves and the humans all around them.
So how did you get involved with this project?
Well, I'd done a big collaboration with the director, Duncan Jones, who did, you know, Mute and Moon and Warcraft, and is midway through post on the Rogue Trooper film called Maddie. So I had a bit of a reputation for working with people who are outside comics and who wanted to do a story in comics. And a mutual friend of ours knew Cliff, and Cliff had been talking about wanting to do Scrapper as a comic, and the friend who was John Nee, who used to be publisher of Wildstorm and then Marvel, connected us, and we got along really well. And originally we thought we'd just do, you know, a kind of a teaser issue, a one and done, which would be that first issue that Sandy drew. And then we were having so much fun. We're like, you know, let's just do the whole book. Like, let's just do the whole story. And so we pitched it to Image as a 6-issue mini. And unfortunately, Sandy, when we asked him to do the first issue, the then only issue, was like, I can do this. This works out great because right afterwards, I'm going on to a graphic novel project that I've been hired to do. And so we finished the first issue, and then we got the Image deal, and we were like, Sandy, can you do the rest? And he's like, guys, what part of I'm moving on to a graphic novel project that's been scheduled for 2 years did you not understand? And we're like, shucks. So we brought on Ryan Kelly, who did an amazing job. I mean, I actually, you know, Ryan can draw literally anything, and Jordy to do colors, and off we went. And it was my first foray back to monthly comics in a very, very long time. I do work in 2000 AD. I've got Full Tilt Boogie serializing right now in the Prague. I do graphic novels. I've got Parasocial out, which is my second graphic novel with Erica Henderson from Image, and Bad Karma, which is a collection of my panel syndicate book with Ryan Howe and Dee Cunniff, which is a giant, like 320-page hardback out from Image. And that's generally the way I prefer to work. So switching back to monthly was fun in the whole, like, you're writing a little story with a giant cliffhanger at the end thing. But wow, it was, like making a comic, not too hard. Making a new comic every month, really quite difficult. But we had a lot of fun doing it, and it serialized last year. And then the fun thing about Image is if you ask them if your trade paperback can actually be a hardback, they're like, yeah, sure. And their hardback print quality is amazing. And the pricing is really good. So we've got this, like, you know, 200 odd page hardback with beautiful new wrap cover art for the trade. And it's like $19.99. You know, it's cheaper than a 4-issue Marvel trade paperback. And the print quality is like French bande dessinée quality. So, like, the one thing I try to do with books is we spend a lot of time thinking about the design of them, making them stand out on the shelf, but also making them really nice objects. Because, like, people either read it on digital and that's fine, or they trade weight, or they buy the issues and the trade. And I figure if people are going to buy the issues and the trade, I want the trade to be a really, really beautifully produced product with like beautiful end papers and new design and everything like that. And so that's what we try to do with our collected editions. That's why I always do those hardbacks.
Very nice. Love a good hardback. Cliff, who you worked with, his background is in video games, stuff like Gears of War and Unreal. How much of this for you was kind of, for lack of a better term, teaching Cliff how to comics?
I mean, Cliff's an incredibly solid storyteller. The only thing is that he's used to storytelling in games where you have to have a lot of detail and a lot of story. Because like you might go left at the junction, or you go right, or you might do this. Like it has to be a branching story with a lot of moving parts in it to keep the narrative flowing and the gamer interested. So he had this entire like plan for Scrapper with like so many amazing ideas. And then I had to be like, okay, well, we can only show part of that in the comic. So we're taking like one subplot from the game and making it, you know, of what would be a game version of it, because he thinks in games and doing that story. And, you know, sometimes he'd be like, hey, well, what if we do this thing? And I'd be like, we were going to do 5 issues. Now we're doing 6. We don't actually have room to do that without squashing the pacing. But sometimes he'd suggest something and I'd be like, yeah, I can put that in. His ideas always made the story better. It's just sometimes we didn't quite have room for them. So it actually worked really well. I mean, both Duncan and Cliff have been wonderful collaborators, very generous people, like very, very down to earth. Neither of us have an ego neither Cliff nor I have an ego in the process. We just want the best story possible. So, you know, it's like, you know, it doesn't matter whose idea it is. We just go with the best idea.
What are some of the influences that went into this story?
Parts of it were things like Rats of Nim and like the sort of the earlier animated features that had a little more oomph to them and a little more peril. There was a little bit of some anime in there. Of course, because my work for 2000 AD, there was a bit of, you know, Judge Dredd, Mega City 1 in there. Cliff will have to speak to his own influences. And then, of course, the fact that we're both pet owners, and feel a certain way about our pets. And I volunteered for a dog rescue, which also occasionally rescues cats and rabbits and other things, for over a decade now. So, you know, I have a lot of opinions about like urban animals and stray animals and the presence of animals in cities that we got to work out.
I'm glad you mentioned Secret of Nim, because I was thinking about those sort of Don Bluth animated movies while I was reading this. So like that American Tail, All Dogs Go to Heaven, specifically because, as you said, I mean, those movies don't play. They really do not. I remember seeing those as a kid and you know, seeing
the peril. To the jugular.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a bit like Black Hole, Disney's kids film. Like Black Hole is... Yeah. Traumatized a generation of children.
The towards the end of Secret of Nim, when one of the rats gets crushed under falling debris, and you like see a hand sticking out from under it. Yeah, Disney don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, the funny thing about the we wanted to make it all ages accessible, so we did some things like the uppercase, lowercase lettering, keeping the pop culture references really low, because I hate a lot of comics all age stuff, which is really just like fan service for a particular TV show with like lots of pop culture references. And it's like, no, that's not actually all ages. That's something else. That's juvenile. that's just juvenile. It's not actually for kids. Because if you have a kid, you've shown them some of those. They're just like, I don't get any of these references. So we tried to make it mostly all ages friendly. And the all ages rules, you know, you can't show blood. Things happen, so you know, bad things happen, but they happen off panel, and they're almost stronger for happening off panel. There's no swearing, there's no sex, obviously. So we found interesting ways around making this a very emotionally impactful story within the general all ages rules.
you know, just kind of getting back to the Bluth thing, you know, I was thinking about, especially All Dogs Go to Heaven, you know, again, book with animals, but the thing I liked about that movie now, or thing I appreciate about that movie now as an adult, is that somebody had the foresight to say, you know what kids are missing out on in whatever year that movie came out? The timeless on-screen friendship of Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise. And I say that as somebody with a deep abiding love of the Cannonball Run movies.
Same.
Yeah. But tell us about your dog.
But actually, you know, like Don Bluth actually has read Scrapper.
Oh, really now? Wow. Oh,
that's cool. Yeah.
Because Cliff ran into him and was like, hey, we did this book. And, you know, we did a lot of it based on both of us, like, loving your works, Mr. Bluth. Because, you know, there was a lot of, like, early Don Bluth, like, photo, like, reference that got sent to Sandy and got sent to Ryan. And Don Bluth was like, read it, and he was like, I love it, which was pretty cool, you know.
That's amazing.
So my dog, I have a 16-year-old pit mix. He is actually sleeping right next to me as we speak. I've had him since he was 12. I volunteer for a special needs dog rescue, which means, and I also have a teenager who runs me ragged. So, you know, I tend to adopt senior dogs because, like, they're chill and I like their vibe. So we adopted Sarge when he was 12. We had another dog named Felicia who we adopted when she was 13 a year later, and she actually just passed last month. She'd had cancer when we got her. We had her operated on by Animal Medical Center, which is the local really good vet hospital in New York City. Mm-hmm. Took out a 5-centimeter adrenal tumor, and then which was malignant, and a couple of other tumors. And she had a great 2 years with us. We always say that Fel was here for a good time, not a long time. And she was just a great, great dog. Loved everybody. Everyone loved her. Made Sarge better with our cat. Because every so often, Sarge, who's really arthritic because he's part bulldog, would be like, I'll chase the cat. The cat's like, nerd, please. you know, like, the cat's like walking slowly away, like, yeah, can't catch me. Cat goes upstairs. You know, like, Sarge is basically a Dalek. He can't do stairs. An old modern dog. I have to, like, yeah, if you imagine me, like, Zercher squatting this 50-pound pit bull up the front steps of our house in New York, because he can't get up by himself. But yeah, Fel passed away, and we miss her terribly, but also, like, I'm happy. Like, I'm normally a one-dog household, and the two-dog thing only happened because it was Christmas. She was in the shelter. She was 13. I knew Sarge, so-called because he's the fun police. If people are having too much fun, he used to bark at you. Sarge is like the most, like, heterosexually coded dog I've ever met. Like, he is just such a little macho dude, doesn't like other dudes, loves the ladies, hasn't been able to do anything about the ladies since, like, the Obama administration, but, like, he loves the ladies. And so I'm like, if I bring a large, nice lady dog into the house, he's going to be fine with her. And lo, they were like best friends. They were really cute. And nobody ever could figure out how old they were because they were both white. And so like, you couldn't tell the muzzle was going white because the muzzle was already white.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of Sarge in Tank, in Scrapper's buddy in Scrapper. I wanted a pit in there, and I thought, like, it would be good if he was just this kind of, like, slightly, like he's very street smart, but he's also, like, a little arthritic and he can't run as fast, and he'll kind of do the shortcut if he can.
And you said there's a cat?
Oh, this cat. Well, there's now two cats. After Fel passed away, we're in the process of moving outside of New York, actually, to a much bigger place. So we had one cat, which was my mother's cat. When my mother went into a care home, we took the cat. Her name is Ruffles. She's beautiful, elegant little Bengal mix, nicest cat ever. Like just beautiful, knows it, knows all her angles, poses beautifully. Affectionate, talkative, great cat. We went to the local shelter near where we're moving because my daughter wanted to volunteer in the cat section. And there was this incredibly plain, dark gray tabby who was just, like, racked out in a corner, not in the bed. Like, you know how, like, little toddlers occasionally go meet, meet, meet around the house, on like, crawl around the house, and then they go quiet and you realize they're just, like, completely just child posed out in a corner because like the wind up has gone down and they're just napping. He was doing that like in a corner. And then we asked about it and they're like, oh, that's Angelo. He's older and has like he has seizures and he's just very quiet. We came back and like met Angelo again because my daughter had come again for her volunteer interview. And then we're like, you know, we could adopt Angelo because like mellow older pets are kind of our vibe. So we adopted Angelo and he got renamed Baloney Man because my daughter named him. And he's great. He sleeps a lot, but Ruffles has finally stopped being dramatic about it. Cause she's been like hissing at him, but that's just because she is just a drama queen. He's been fine. Had a little initial trouble with him cause he hated being in the crate when we were going between our New York apartment and the new house. And back and forth and, you know, caused him a significant amount of anxiety, which resulted in like doing things in the crate that needed to be cleaned up. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, well, what if we just put him on a little harness, like one of those little dog harnesses, like for small dogs. And he loved that. Like he just spent the next trip up to the house in like on a cat bed in my daughter's lap, like with a little harness on and a leash on. He was fine in the harness. He loved it. Put it on him. He was like, oh, this is fine. And then he's like looking out the window and having a great time. Like before he'd been like screaming the entire time in the crate and hating it. And now he's just like looking around like, who can I come up front? No, you can't. Can I go in the truck? No, you also can't go in that track. You will stay in the back seat, but you may wander. So he's been a real character. So yeah, now we have two cats and, you know, at either end of the cat spectrum, you know, the beautiful, elegant cat. And then just the kind of like, just the most average cat known to mankind, but with a great deal of charm and the old pet. And that's kind of going to be it for the pet sweepstakes.
It's certainly a jackpot. And especially the name Baloney Man. That is an A+ name.
Well, after he was doing things in the crate, his nickname got to be BM for a while.
That works out.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Like every pet has the name, the actual name they're supposed to have, and then they've got like eight other names.
That is 100% true. So we have two miniature dachshunds, and our older one is Chewy, who more often than not we call Bird, and then the younger one Lola we call Derp, because she's. She's very sweet, but she is dumb as a box of rocks on blocks.
Yeah, I mean, mini dachshunds, those are like 100 pounds of dog in a 10 pound bag.
Some days, yes. Oh, man. Yeah, Matt, I can see the gear spinning.
I'm just thinking about the 8 million nicknames that our recently departed Queen Bess had. Because she was Miss Elizabeth when we adopted her, and that was she was Queen Bess, her first of her name, ruler of the couch and all she surveys.
Very good.
Yeah, no, she was she was one of those dainty queens who, you know, again, knew all of her angles and was very prim and proper. And we were the one cat house, except for we adopted the, you know, 15-year-old, the cat that had been deemed unadoptable because he had a heart condition and kidney conditions and knew he wasn't going to be with any house for too much longer. But my wife saw a photo of him and fell in love. And I pointed out, oh, he's got a big head and gangly legs and he looks like he trips on things. You got to type. but Cal was a good, good boy, and Bess was not happy to have another cat in the house for the year that he was hanging around.
Ruffles has chilled out after like a couple of weeks. Like they aren't besties yet. I have a feeling they will eventually become friendly, like quite friendly. But like Ruffles just had to have, you know, any change to the household when we've had foster dogs in or when Fel, like there's 2 weeks of like sulking, occasional yelling, and at least one piss where piss should not happen. Which is how cats show their unhappy.
Bess reached the point after a couple of months where she didn't actively hiss or swipe at him anymore, but she never let him get within 2 feet of me because I was her person. And it was just like, no, you can sit near her, but him, he's mine.
Yep. Interesting. See, Ruffles would hiss at him when he would come close, especially around the food. And I fed them separately for a while. And she's gradually stopped that, but she would never swipe at him and she would never go after him. And she was okay with me petting him. And in fact, he has a little bed in the closet in my room because the closet has curtains in front of it. So he has this little bed fort with the curtains just like slightly spread around it so he can go in and out. But Ruffles normally sleeps in my daughter's bed anyway, so. But we have peace in the household now. It's been a couple of weeks of change, but everything's good now.
Excellent. Now, in the letter at the back of the book, Cliff writes about his Australian Shepherd Teddy, and below it, there's a photo of young Scrapper who's blue tinted throughout the book, and he mentions there having wanted to write something for kids who had aged out of Paw Patrol, but, still wanted dogs being or animals being heroic. And it occurs to me, looking at this little blue dog, that Scrapper gives a lot of weaponized Bluey. And I love that for everybody.
I never thought about that, but you're right.
He beat me to that question because I was trying to figure out the way to make a weaponized Bluey joke myself.
My daughter grew up on Paw Patrol, and we didn't want to do like a dog cop story, so we went the dog vigilante route. It was also just fun incorporating a lot of urban animals as well. Like there are the pigeons were kind of a big hit at Image, and every time every time a new issue of Scrapper came out, apparently the Image staff group chat would have like panels of the pigeons. The pigeons are like fanboys with ADHD is the best way I can describe them. Like very severe ADHD.
Yeah, whoever gets the credit for the one pigeon that kept saying "Notice me, Senpai," he was my favorite.
I don't know. I like Bag of Chips. Bag of Chips penguin was pigeon was my favorite. Like all the pigeons would be doing something, and another one would be like, "Oh, Bag of Chips." but yeah, Notice Me Senpai was and a lot of the pigeons like we didn't really dialogue them before. There would be a little dialogue for the main pigeon action, but then Ryan would just draw background pigeons, and when I was lettering it, because I also lettered the book, I just throw in background pigeon jokes, and a lot of the pigeon stuff happened on the page, like the gags were written on the page, and I'm fairly sure Notice Me Senpai came on the page.
That's excellent. Ultimately, the message of this book for younger readers is fuck fascism, a no-brainer but incredibly necessary for our times. Which of you and Cliff was more gung-ho for dismantling authoritarian systems in the writing of this book?
I mean, it was pretty equal, I gotta say. He had proposed the structure, like he proposed the structure of New Verona and stuff like that. I came up with a MacGuffin of what the baddies were trying to do and how it affected the animals, and some of the mechanics of like how they then overcame them. But it was Cliff's idea from the beginning that there was this totalitarian group out there who used anything at their disposal to kind of keep control. And some of that anything was controlling animals as well. Mm-hmm. We had to have them come down in a really truly satisfying way.
Mm-hmm. And on that anti-fascist note, the quote, "A cat is never on the side of power," needs to be made into a button or a patch or a t-shirt or something I can wear, because
that's a Chris Marker quote, though. That's not actually me.
Really?
Yes.
Huh. I like that. That makes me happy.
Well, he was the he was a director and a photographer who did this film called La Jetée, Anyway, he French guy, and he was definitely he was the one who said, I think it was in an essay, a cat is never on the side of power, and it's just one of the fundamental truths of the world.
Indeed. Matt, I was definitely curious reading this book. Which cat was your favorite?
Well, I bow to the terrible telepathic might of Midnight, because a telepathic cat who can mind control you is both terrifying and the logical extension of toxoplasmosis. But I also do love a good chonky boy, so Snowball is a very close second.
I love Snowball a lot. I wanted to have a chonky boy who was like, you know, who was full of character and like additive to the story process, and had his own strengths.
There's a panel of him and the pigeons that was just, it is probably my favorite single panel in the book. It just made me smile.
Yeah, no, I love that, and I was happy to be able to do that panel, because it was just such a nice moment. Like, you have to have nice moments in these books. Like, and sometimes, you know, a character's reentrance being particularly charming, you know, especially as you're about to go into a grim and gritty battle, really helps.
There's a page in issue 2 where we see messages from Smite in the gutters about indentured servitude that are just so darkly funny. They remind me of some of the newsreels in Starship Troopers, which, when looked at as it was intended, is an underappreciated satiric gem.
Yes.
I don't know if there's a specific question here so much as wanting to know how you approached satire in this, in general, and in an all ages book like this in particular.
I mean, again, my ability to do satire is heavily influenced by, you know, growing up reading and also working for 2000 AD, where, you know, it is understood that Judge Dredd is in large part a satire. Judge Dredd is not, you know, a goal. And it's a comic that's walked the line, especially recently when Rob Williams has been writing it. He just did an Abolish the Judges arc with Arthur Wyatt and Henry Flint. That's truly amazing. You know, Judge Dredd for a very long time has walked a really thin but excellent line, and a very hard line on you know, being about, on Dredd is not the hero. Like, the system is not the hero. Dredd is the whole idea of Mega City One and the Justice Department is a satire of a kind of fascism. So I think you can do satire in a very sophisticated way. And I think kids understand it. You could, without being too heavy-handed. Like, I didn't want to, like, again, in a video game, for example, that entire jail sequence, jail square area, Smite announcement thing, would have been an entire subplot, but it was actually just, it was quite fun to keep it as a very contained little drive-by to like deepen people's understanding of the world and why these people, the Smite wasn't bad just for animals, but then also not spend a lot of time there. And again, some of my choices in storytelling come down to the fact that I'm lettering the book myself. And the, you know, it was not in the script to leave the panel borders there for me to put stuff in them. It just, Ryan's art was so nice, I didn't want to cover it up. And it just worked nicely in putting them in the gutters like that. I felt it made the page very effective without detracting from Ryan's art.
I've noticed in some of your other work, music plays a part. The playlist that runs through Parasocial, the musical numbers that run through Bad Girls. This book doesn't have that in the same way, but in your head, do you have a playlist soundtrack to Scrapper?
Gosh, you know, I don't. Because both Bad Girls and Parasocial were structured as kind of like one complete thing where I could spend a lot of time having built the story out, thinking about how music worked in it. I mean, more so in Bad Girls because it's almost all diegetic music. With Scrapper, the monthly pace of it meant that I was really just crushing to get the book out the door. So I didn't have a lot of time to step back and then add on, you know, what the musical numbers would be. I'd sort of love to hear people's suggestions or what they thought, or like, I'd love to hear other people do playlists for it. That would be a lot of fun for me because I'm always the one thinking up the music. And Parasocial was just, you know, was fun because it was so pop culture. Parasocial was so interwoven with the concept of pop culture and social media that having a playlist with it that was actually in the book and it was occasionally diegetic was just a fun version of that. Kind of extended that metaphor even further.
Staying on the topic of music for a bit, you've directed quite a few music videos. Has your eye for composition there affected the way you construct a comic script, or sort of vice versa, the ideas of laying out a page helps you with your vision as a director?
The directing and also storyboarding a lot of those videos and editing them helped my visual storytelling ability immensely. Someone on one of the social media sites, some artist, was talking about how terrible it is that writers call shot sizes and angles now. I absolutely do that. I'm guilty. But also part of it's because my scripts are quite detailed. Part of it's because I have to be convinced that the scene I'm writing can work visually before I hand it off to somebody else. I don't consider it someone else's responsibility to make the scene work visually. I need to, for me, there needs to be a baseline of, yes, this works with like this. And then if someone else can make it better and change it as they draw it, that's fine. But I know it's drawable. I know the storytelling beats work. I know we can get from point like panel one to panel six and it hangs together. And there is in fact, like, you know, those six panels are drawable on a page. So like, you know, I will go through and, you know, the little things you learn. I mean, film and comics are very different visual languages. In filmmaking, you know, you as the director and editor have control of time unless it's Basic Instinct, you know, like where like, you know, a 2 minute scene is always going to take 2 minutes. In comics, the reader has control of time. You can very much influence their perception of time and how fast or slow they go through the page. And there are a lot of very interesting technical storytelling ways to do that. Ultimately, the reader decides how long they spend on a page and they can flip forward and flip back, and it's very easy. Whereas going back in a movie is a little bit harder. But there are some things that the language of cinematography does help with for comics, like dumb things like cutting from a medium to a medium never really works. It's like you can do it, but it's not great. You want to change shot sizes in between when you cut from one shot to another. It just livens up the story a lot. If you're not like, you know, if you want to cut from a medium to a medium, you just consider moving the camera rather than doing a hard cut. So that went into a lot of my thinking. You know, the importance of cutaways, but that was really something that reading a lot of Naoki Urasawa taught me. You know, cutting away to something else that's like, you know, a small detail while dialogue is going on can kind of give a break from the dialogue and also build out the scene and the feeling of the environment a little bit more. I'm very much the writer I am today because of my experience directing.
Now, in addition to Scrapper, you've also got, and you did mention this already, a serial right now in 2000 AD. It's a new volume of Full Tilt Boogie, which is your teen bounty hunter space opera with Eduardo Ocaña. How do you like working in the serial format where you only have, you know, we talked about kind of the restrictions of monthly comics, but, you know, in the serial format where you only have a few pages to move the plot forward at a time as opposed to...
6 pages. Yep, 5 to 6 pages.
Yeah.
It's fun. I mean, I cheat at the serial format in that I write the entire arc at once. And Ed gets like the entire arc. We just finished the third and final arc, and I just got it approved. So yay! So Ed gets that all at once. Part of the reason I do that is these are essentially thrillers, and the problem with thrillers is they're not written; they're rewritten. So if I wrote each segment and then send it off to like Ed and Tharg, I'd get to episode 7 and be like, oh shit, this would be so much better if I just set this thing up slightly differently in episode 2. Hey, Ed, if you started drawing episode 2, can I change this yet? Like, it's just much easier to do the whole thing. Then A, it reads really well in collection. B, you can still add in the cliffhangers you want to add for the serialized installments. And C, it's just some, it ends up being just a much more coherent story to be able to make sure that, you know, things you start doing at the end, you've got proper seating for in the beginning. But I like the 5-page form, the 5 to 6 page 2000 AD format. It's tough, but once you get it, you really get it. And one of the great fun things to do with it is you're creating the illusion of space. You're doing like 5-6 panels a page on average, probably more like 6 in 2000 AD. And you've got very little room to tell a complete story. So if you can do a splash page or do a double page spread at a particular moment in a 5 or 6 page serialized chunk, it really hits the reader much more than it normally would, because, you know, normally people are like just packing story in as much as they can. And I love, like, there are a couple of really good double page spreads in this arc of Full Tilt Boogie that I'm very happy with. And also Ed's honestly so great at drawing like spaceships in sci-fi detail that every so often you just want to point him at a really good image and be like, spend, draw that over the entire page, Ed, and he'll do that, and it'll be amazing.
Sort of generally, without going into story spoilers, you know, what was something you were looking to do differently with this volume of the story?
The Full Tilt Boogie?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were deepening out a lot of the character work and setting up things for the final arc. I think one of the things I was most proud of doing with it is there's a lot of horror in it. And again, this is an all ages book. It was one of the few all ages serials to come out of 2000 AD Regened that really got picked up by the audience, possibly because it's, you know, it's like anime all ages. It's, you know, it has that emotional punch so that older readers don't feel like they're being talked down to. And kids get, because kids like dark stories. And so there are a couple of very like strange horror moments in, well, in, you know, you can probably guess it by the we have the cover this week of 2080 that are very, very scary, but they're not bloody. One of them's more eerie horror, eerie cosmic horror, and the other is just a, you know, more of an abandoned house kind of horror thing. But it's fun to be able, again, it's fun to be able to do things really effectively within the all ages limitations. Because I feel like sometimes comics, you know, leans on cheap gore and ultra violence a little too hard as a way of being edgy. And I think you can be much edgier if you just do really good character work and imply things rather than having to show them. And kids stuff teaches you to imply things.
2000 AD is a book that runs the gamut of tones, you know, from like your Full Tilt Boogie to your Judge Dredd, and you've written both. So, you know, how does it feel to sort of, I guess, contain multitudes on that same level?
I mean, I've, you know, I've contain multitudes just naturally in what I do. Part of it is, again, I'm doing big graphic novels. And when I finish a big graphic novel that's doing one thing, I really want to go do something else. I mean, you know, I love Ed Brubaker, but he does the same kind of story. Like, Ed does a thing, and he never kind of gets out of that track. He does that thing extremely well. He does that thing much better than I could ever do that thing, but he only does that thing. And I couldn't do that. Like, I finished Bad Karma, an experience I absolutely loved with just, you know, the best collaborators. And I'm like, man, I'm not doing it like a set right now contemporary book, you know, again for a little bit. Like, I just need something else to do. And I went off and did the final Full Tilt Boogie arc, which was a lot of fun, because Full Tilt Boogie is very, you know, more than any other book, I kind of fly by the seat of my pants in that book. Although, again, because I'm writing entire arcs at a time, it doesn't seem like it. But I'm a little freer with that book because it's a world that's completely made up. No one's going to say, oh, well, you didn't do that bit right, you know. Because Bad Karma is about two Army veterans and is set in real places. And, you know, most people are cool to roll with it. And we, you know, we had the book extensively reviewed by friends of ours who are in the Army, who are recent veterans, or who have the physical disabilities that the characters in the book have, et cetera, et cetera. Even had a friend in Russia House comment on the CIA parts of it. But, you know, sometimes you just want to make shit up wholesale.
Certainly.
So yeah, it's a way of staying sane, is just like going between different genres, different subjects, different tonalities.
So there's a bit of kayfabe that comes with 2000 AD that I appreciate, and you mentioned it already, but I will ask you, how is Tharg as an editor? What is the most memorable note you've ever gotten from him?
Tharg's a very chill editor. I think, I mean, the problem is, you know, I've been doing this for a while, and, you know, I'm very receptive to notes, but I also try to put in the best work I can so that, you know, people don't have to spend a lot of time rewriting it or working on it. And, you know, I think one of the reasons I continue to work with 2000 AD is I give them really clean stories. You know, I pitch things to Tharg where he's been like, you know, I don't think this is right. This is more the direction we want to take, when it's doing, you know, one of the established characters like Rogue Trooper or Judge Dredd. And then that's fine. You know, like, it's, I just repitch it. And, you know, I go away, think about it for a while, and repitch it more in the direction that they've suggested. I can always find something to do. I mean, the worlds are big enough. But, you know, Tharg's a really, really solid editor. I have a lot of affection for him. And the way in which he's also always trying to kind of try new things in 2000 AD and bring in new people. Regened was one of it. They did a women's issue. You know, they're very keen to bring in new readers, new blood, new stories, in a way that, and in a very genuine way, not in a sort of half-assed way like I've seen some of the American mainstream publishers do.
Well, as we start to wind down here, is there anything else coming up for you that you can talk about that you want to make sure you get a plug in for?
Gosh, I don't think I have anything coming out for a while. It's Scrapper and 2000 AD, and everything else hasn't been announced, unfortunately. Again, this is what happens when you do graphic novels. Like, you have three in one year, which is, we had, you know, or three in a very short space of time. And then they're like, buses, like, it's going to be another 2 years before I've got another one coming out. I don't mind that. You know, it's just, they take a while. And now I'm, you know, they all came out. So I'm, you know, I've got an all ages book with Carla Speed McNeil and Jen Manley Lee, who are the No Mercy team with me, that we're working on another animal story. That's probably not going to be out until like 2025, 2026. I've got a heist book that I'm doing with Tom Fowler that's, again, going to be another couple years. You know, stuff's happening. It's just happening. I kind of believe that, like, I've put out a lot of books, so I don't have to have a book out at any given time, because, like, I have books, and the book comes out when it's finished, you know, not before.
Mm-hmm. Any upcoming signings or appearances, conventions, anything like that?
I hardly ever do signings or appearances. Conventions are exhausting. And you know, as a single mom with pets, the whole, you know, like pet boarding, arranging childcare stuff is just, it ain't worth it. I was invited to SDCC last summer, did that. I don't think I'll be going to another convention for another couple of years.
What are you reading right now? Comics, prose, whatever.
God, I'm doing a lot of research reading for my book with Fowler because it's a medieval heist book. I've done most of the research reading, but now I'm having to go back because I'm scripting it and go, oh, wait, where was this person when this thing happened? And again, like I could just make it up, but part of me like takes a perverse joy in like having actual proper history in the book. Mm-hmm. What else am I reading? I can't even remember. I'm mostly moving house. We put our apartment on the market this past weekend, so most of my spare time is spent cleaning and putting things in boxes or taking them out of boxes. I'm trying to think anything I've read recently, and I just can't.
Well, I'm sorry. What was the last movie you saw?
Oh, Tarkovsky's Nostalgia, which was I've took an afternoon off and went to see like a noontime showing down at Film Forum, 4K restoration, and you know, noontime showings are one like to 11 a.m. noontime showing of a long art house film. It just makes the whole day great. You feel like you got away with something, you know, like go in there and enjoy your film. And then you walk out and the rest of the day is just like magical.
Matt, I know you can attest to that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Alex, this has been a fantastic time. Final question as we release you back into the world. How can people follow you online and keep up with Scrapper and Full Tilt Boogie and everything else that you have going on?
I'm on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Twitter as Alex DeCampi, first name, last name. I post occasionally.
There you go. Alex, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's show. As a reminder, WMQ&A is part of ComicsXF, where you can find this podcast along with our sister podcasts, Battle of the Atom and Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast co-hosted by Matt Lazowitz and Will Nevin. You can listen to WMQ&A on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Amazon Music, Audible, and at ComicsXF.com, where new episodes move Tuesday mornings. You can support ComicsXF at patreon.com/ComicsXF, where a $1 donation gets you a shout-out at the end of every episode of WMQ&A. A $2 donation gets you early access to WMQ&A and a shout-out at the end of every episode. A $3 donation gets you a sticker, early access, and a shout-out. A $5 donation gets you access to our monthly bonus podcast, Our Son Pete, a deep dive into the comic appearances of British mutant super spy Pete Wisdom. A $25 donation lets you request a primer, one of our custom reading guides for a series, character, or creator. And a $50 donation lets you advertise on the show. Big thanks to our patrons, Joel Elod, Shelf Dust, Lisa Slack, Will Redman, Tobias Carroll, Mike Sagawa, Will Nevin, Liz Large, Asimov Fangirl, Carla Pacheco, and Robert Secundus. You're all special, and we love you. You can follow ComicsXF on Twitter at ComicsXF, me at Daniel P. Grote, and Matt Lazowitz at MattLaz1013. You can also follow ComicsXF on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. And until next week, remember, a supervillain once tried to trick Superman and Big Barda into making a sex tape.
WMQA.